When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name is Annie McManus. Welcome to Changes. Now, a lot of the people you'll hear on this podcast are famous people that you'll know, you know, artists and authors and activists and, you know, people who are in the public eye. But one of the things we like to do on this podcast is bring you everyday people with extraordinary stories. We've brought you people like Paddy in the past, you know, a man who was homeless and a drug addict for years and told the story of the change of kind of getting back off the streets into housing and into sobriety. We've told you the story of Nigel Bromage, who suffered huge ideological change when he was groomed by the far right, and how he escaped from that and kind of got out of that back into a more kind of measured way of thinking. This week, I am introducing you to a rather wonderful lady called Ariel Bruce. Now, this all happened because I was in the playground with another school mom friend of mine who suggested, after listening to my podcast, that maybe I might want to speak to Ariel. Ariel is not someone that, you know, you will find. She's a person that kind of lives in the shadows. Yeah, she has a website because she's a professional, but she's never kind of done a podcast before. She's never really been on the television or anything like that before. But she works in television behind the scenes, specifically on a TV show called Long Lost Family. You see, Ariel's job is to find people. She's pretty much a private investigator. She doesn't call herself that, but on paper, that's what she does. She traces people. She specializes in unifying families that have been split up by adoption. And she is a qualified social worker. She's so unique in what she does. She's at the top of her game. She's been called a gene genius. The Daily Telegraph called her the Agatha Christie of the adoption world. So I reached out to Ariel on email, and she was very kind and said she would love to do it. And you're about to hear this conversation that we had. A little background on Ariel quickly. She was born in Hampstead. Her parents were Jewish refugees, and at the age of 12, she was placed into care, went on to have six different foster parents. So this experience had a profound effect on her, as you can imagine, and really gave her the motivation to go into social work herself. Ariel has been working in the game for 40 years. She has a vast wealth of knowledge and experience and anecdotes. And you'll hear a couple of personal stories of kind of work that she's done and families that she's reunited in here that really, really are heart-wrenching. We also talk about why people do and don't search for family, you know, why she would ever say no to requests to trace people, and what she would like to see change in the future in terms of the care system for children. Ariel is extraordinary. She's very funny and very cheeky and mischievous and incredibly endearing for it. It's a fascinating listen. So excited to bring you this. Welcome to Changes, Ariel Bruce. Ariel Bruce, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you for the time.
Not at all.
Okay, so you have said that you are a poacher turned gamekeeper. And I thought that was a nice place to start because it's such a wonderful description of what you do. So can you elaborate on that description?
Gosh, okay, you've obviously done your homework. In the simplest of terms, I was in care as a child for part of my childhood. And so there's something sort of about a reverse of deciding that in later life that I can do that job better than those that were there to look after me, and therefore, you know, becoming qualified to do that. So I think that's the simplest of terms. But I think that also what is it sort of inherent in that is that I often think that the sort of delinquent side of me, which is, you know, really quite strong, quite naughty. You know, some people have a mischievous, I mean, I don't think it's to do harm, but a kind of mischievousness. I've been able to put it to use to the good. You know, I sometimes think that otherwise I would have been hanging around on street corners making mischief, and instead somehow I was able to use that way of thinking about things or being somewhat defiant when I was younger to a good purpose. So I think that's what I meant when I said it.
And if you met someone on the street and they asked you that dreaded question, what do you do? What would you answer?
It's a very difficult question, I mean, partly because it opens up always a huge conversation that people want to have with me. And most of the time that's fabulous and I'm thrilled. And sometimes I'm not. When I was younger, I would sometimes go to parties and say that I was a secretary. And then people would say that they didn't believe me. It didn't sort of make sense and didn't tally. That was always difficult. Realistically, I would say that I'm a social worker who traces missing family members.
And can you talk me through your process? Because, you know, people have called you a private investigator, and I'm sure, you know, it depends on what type of person you are, how you will describe yourself, but you do seem to have a very unique kind of niche way of working where your experience brings a whole new experience to the job that other people would call a private investigator job. What is your process in terms of how you work?
Well, that's a bit difficult. On one level, the answer to your question is, give me a puzzle and I'll tell you how to solve it. And quite often people phone me. They say to me, look, I want you to find my father. So the first question I want to know is, exactly what do you know about him? What was his name? If his name was John Smith, I can immediately compute that there are going to be 40,000 people in this country called John Smith. But if his name was a rare one, then I'm always doing a calculation. I suppose that I see myself as a functionary in a way. My job is to make available a series of choices to people. As you know, I trained as a social worker. That gave me a level of access that maybe otherwise I would not have had. And I hope, as part of that training, some insight. At the heart of it, I do think that people have a right to make an informed decision about family contacts and information and knowledge about themselves. And I see myself as a functionary to do that.
So let's go to your first change and the first question that we asked you, which is about a change that you experienced in your childhood that's had a big impact on you. So tell us about that.
Well, I come from a rather sort of splendidly dysfunctional family.
Right.
I was an only child of parents, both of whom had themselves had quite tragic backgrounds. My mother's mother had killed herself when my mother was two. Right. My mother had been stateless during the 30s. I'd come to England in 1939. As a Jewish refugee. And my father had been brought up in orphanages in this country and had not had an education. And they were both people who I have described as escaping forwards. They had no past. They had no background. And with that came my absolute curiosity about secrets, because all of their backgrounds were full of secrets. And we had no relations, aunts, uncles, grandparents. There was nothing there. It was just a sort of a void. So sadly, my mother was not able to parent. And I ended up in care. And I think the first change, the sort of enormous shift, was that shift both into care, but also what I learnt from it. And I lived with six different sets of foster parents, partly because nobody made plans within local authority for what was to happen to me. Mm. I was a grammar school child who wouldn't go to school. So, you know, it was problematic for them.
And how old were you, Ariel, when you got taken into care?
I was about 12 and a half.
Right.
I think what I got from that was this amazing understanding that there are many, many different worlds. You know, that you inhabit one world when you grow up and you think that that is the universe. But when you go to live in these other places, what you realise is all these different extraordinary worlds to which you don't belong, but you may observe. And I think that was amazing. My final foster parents were my then grammar school headmaster and his wife. And the change I would speak of is that I entered this family. I got five brothers, which I still have.
Wow.
And a mum and dad who were, you know, terrific. I mean, alien creatures to me. They were very upper middle class English, but totally decent and completely committed. And I gave them hell, as you can imagine. You know, who wouldn't?
How long did you stay with this family then?
I lived with them from 14 and three quarters.
Wow.
My mum and dad died about 12 years ago. So they fulfilled a need that I had. My father is still alive and I'm close to him. My real father.
Your birth father,
My mother is dead. Somehow I retain that duality of one being where I come from and the other being on one level where I was going. Mm. And that was a huge change.
Yeah, and these brothers, tell me about these brothers. Where did you come in the chronology of age there?
So I'm one from the bottom.
Right. All these big brothers must have given you a big sense of safety and security. Did you get that?
Well, in fact, the older four were all the way at university or college.
Got it.
And so toing and froing. But yes, and certainly as we've got older, that's been of great pleasure to me.
And how did your adoptive parents then, your foster parents, talk to you about your other life as such, your birth parents? Was that something that was encouraged to still know your parents and have that relationship with them?
That's difficult to answer. You know, we're talking about quite a long time ago.
Sure.
In terms of understanding about these things. So I don't know that it was ever particularly talked about. I knew them. You know, I knew what had happened. I had my own narrative about it. And I don't think it was ever something that was hugely sort of spoken of. I mean, I was really quite upset by that age, you can imagine. And very, very naughty. I mean, it was incredibly naughty. And I'm very dyslexic. So that was not, it was just seen as me being willful at school. I don't think we talked about it particularly. I think they simply had to try to deal with me, you know.
And what are your memories of life before care? Like that's the first 12 years of your life. That's a significant.
Well, you know, it was complicated. Both of my parents are highly intelligent, politically very aware. I think I went on my first Aldermaston to London march when I was 6 or 7, 50 miles, 4 days. It was a privileged upbringing in many ways. But sadly, my mother, you know, was really not, it was difficult for her. It was difficult.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the idea of kind of going into social work, and we'll get to that. But I'm interested in your first experiences of care and being part of the system as such and dealing with the authorities and them dealing with you. Like, what are your memories of those times? And your first instances of that?
Actually, in those days, social workers were not necessarily qualified. But there was a lovely woman, and her name was, I always remember her name. Her name was Esme Henriquez.
Wow.
And she was part of, there's quite a sort of well-known Henriquez family. But she was absolutely terrific. And when I started out in care, I remember going to her house and spending days of looking at books, art books, and listening to music. But later on, perhaps, I had social workers who might have found me a puzzle. It's difficult to remember. You know, I played hooky a lot. I wouldn't go to school. Was obviously intelligent and did absolutely no work. I think I was quite distressing for them.
and do you have memories of the, you know, you had quite a few foster families before you found
yes.
the one that you stayed at. That must have been a really turbulent time.
Yes. I mean, I think I protected myself very well by ensuring like now, I don't even remember their names. I mean, only one other foster family do I know who they were. And I would, you know, I know their names, where they lived and so on. The others, I have no idea. I mean, I can remember or maybe a house, but there are places I don't even know which town I lived in.
Wow.
And I think I dealt with it by completely sort of closing down from it.
Yeah.
And those have been valuable things to take into work. Mm. And by that time, I'd had a family of my own. I mean, I've got four wonderful children myself. After, in my 30s, I started work, by which time, in many ways, in my childhood experience was, you know, somewhat behind me. Perhaps like my own parents, I was only looking forwards by that time. But, you know, I think that it's been true that one has been able to take things from that upbringing, good things, really positive things, forwards, you know. I don't regret it. I mean, I truly don't regret the upbringing I had. I don't think I would be the person I am had I not had it. How can I regret it?
Yeah. This second change then, your adulthood change, you speak of a leap into education. Tell me about this period.
So when my youngest child, Sasha, went to school on her first day at school, I sort of came home and did what you did, which is, I think I vacuum cleaned the house and sat down and thought, well, now what? You know, I'd had my children are all very close in age, and I must have been, when she went to school, I would have been 30 or 31. So I thought, I know, I'll get a job. I'll get a sort of part-time job. I got a job in a children's home, but of course. And I was sort of felt cross about it. Strangely, the thing that made me feel cross was that it was so aesthetically displeasing. You know, that it was unloved, unpainted, yeah, beaten up. And these children, this was their home. And I really minded about that. I decided, you know, in my youthful wisdom, that I could do this better than they could. So I better go and get a training. So I went to Kingston University and basically knocked on the door and said, well, I think you ought to train me as a social worker now. And they had a course for older people because they wanted people who had had some life experience. I did a social work training there and then did some teaching on that course and became a course tutor, had students coming to work with me in my own setup a bit later on. And I think that that leap, you know, that sort of the business about going to university, doing a course, getting that qualification, having mucked about so much at school, I don't know, it was a big change. It was a change for me. It was a change.
So you're working as a social worker, you are teaching social work. When and what was your first experience of tracing someone?
Yes, it was very strange. I, you know, was bringing up the kids and so on, and a young man came to do some painting in the house, a lad, you know, a boy of about 19 or something. And he was very silent, very quiet, nice. And at the time, I bought a painting and I was doing a huge amount of research on understanding who the sitter was. And this young man overheard these conversations at lunchtime about the painting, the research and so on. And he rather shyly one day said to me, look, I'm adopted. I wonder if you could help me find my family, you see. Because I was going to St. Catherine's House, as it was then, which was where the ledgers were. In those days, nothing, of course, was computerised. So one went and actually went through huge, huge ledgers. After some persuasion, I agreed I'd help him. And in fact, it was a technically quite a difficult search, but we were able to resolve it. And I sort of understood that it fused together two very powerful elements in the way I thought and what I was potentially quite good at. And I think that the fusion was of that it had a meaning, that yeah, it had meaning to somebody, not necessarily to me, because I'm quite separate. I don't think I inhabit other people's searches. Hmm. They are theirs. But it had this wonderful fusion of the abstract, the puzzle. And then when you'd done this puzzle, like you'd played a game of chess, and at the end of it, this result had a meaning to someone. Well, who wouldn't want a job like that? How's that for a fantastic job?
So from that moment on, did you then continue?
So then I talked about it at work, because I was working in a local authority social services department. And somebody from within my work came and said, would I help them? Because they were adopted. And then some more. And I sort of then started to think, gosh, there's this huge need for this fusion of skills. And also, it was a very strange time in terms of social work practice, post-adoption services. And I'll try to explain that a bit. The law had changed in 1974 to entitle adopted people to access their original birth certificate. Yeah. But the law only allowed for that. It did not make it statutory that people had a right, for example, to the information in their folders, in their files. That wasn't a right. That was at the discretion of local authorities or adoption agencies.
Wow.
So when I sort of entered into this world, 1986, that sort of time, 85, 86, the very social workers who had made promises both to adopting parents and to birth parents that this would never be disclosed, it would never be opened, had in many ways had the rug pulled from under their feet by what was essentially retrospective legislation.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
75, the law not only changed, but it said, and all the promises we previously made now no longer stand. But the result was that in terms of practice for social workers, there was this underlying feeling that only unhappy people wanted to search for their families of origin. Because there wasn't a real understanding that the search was not necessarily for a person. Mm. The search was for self.
Mm.
You have to have been there. And I go back to that world I inhabited of being in other people's worlds and yet not of them.
Yeah.
To have that insight. And so when I started work independently, for some social workers and for some agencies, the way I saw things, which was quite rights-based, was quite challenging. I also saw and felt that adoption itself had been, for that generation, for the earlier generations, not so much for now, had been the punishment that we meted out to women who had transgressed the sexual and social mores of the day. And therefore, it was a political issue. It wasn't just a sort of, you know, when you actually looked at the fact that 25,000 infant children were adopted every year in the periods up to probably the early 70s, you have to look at why that happened.
Mm.
So I came to it from a feminist point of view, from a ex-care kid point of view, and I was stroppy. I mean, I'm not now, I'm a pussycat. I was stroppy.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting time. Well, now there'd be nothing that I would say or none of my views would be seen as at all controversial.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then it was.
So the idea that people have a right to know their history was controversial. Mad,
yeah.
Isn't it? Now in 2021 to think that.
Yes, but it wasn't like that. It was somehow in the gift of agencies, and many agencies were very reluctant to share information.
Yeah.
And it was complicated. You know, I understand it was, and it remains complicated. I mean, I think there is nothing simple in post-adoption work. You know, it isn't simple.
Ariel, has there ever been a situation, I mean, okay, so since then, so since your 30s, you've been doing this, and, you know, I should say for listeners who don't know Ariel, you know, you have a real reputation now as being one of the go-to people that will successfully find and reunify families. You've been called by The Telegraph the Agatha Christie of the adoption world. I don't know how you feel about that.
Is it The Telegraph bit that I shouldn't know, or the Agatha Christie? I'm not sure. Yeah.
um, And your work on Long Lost Family, you are the first name that comes up in the credits after Davina and Nikki, the other presenter. You know, so you're really at the top of your game when it comes to this. But I wonder, has there ever been a situation in all of your years of experience in tracing people where you said no to someone and where you didn't feel like it was the right thing to do?
Of course. Absolutely. Of course. I ought to explain that I suppose it would be now about 14 or 15 years ago. Gosh, I need to check that. The law again changed and it entitled members of a birth family using an adoption support agency only through a regulated system to, as it were, send a message to an adopted person to say they would welcome contact. Now, they can't be given the adopted person's new identity, but the ASA acts as the go-between, the honest broker. And for a time I was an ASA. So people would come to me and a child of theirs had been adopted, and now that child was sort of 18 and 1 week. And they would say they wanted me to find that young person and ascertain their wishes. And my counsel was always the same. It was, put your name on the contact register, which is a government-run register, which marries up people if both parties are on it. Make sure there's a letter on the file, on the adoption file, so if that young person goes looking for their file, they see that there's a letter, a current letter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at age 18, who wants extra parents? I mean, they're probably busy trying to separate themselves from the ones they've got. And it's just, it's not wrong, it's just not smart. Mm. And much better to wait 5 years, 8 years, until that young person is more established, more separate from their adopters, more able to make a decision for what they want rather than worrying about the impact as much on their lovely parents. So yes, in those circumstances, I have, you know, often declined that work. And there will be other instances where I think, for example, let us say, a grandmother comes to me and says, I want you to trace my grandchild who was placed for adoption. And I say, so what about your child, the mother of the adopted person? And the grandmother says, no, they don't want any contact at all. They would hate it. Well, I have to then say, you know, it's complicated, isn't it? Because on the one hand, this person who hasn't gone out looking themselves yet is going to get a sort of a very complicated message, which they haven't asked for. If they go out looking and they get that complicated message, I understand that. But this is a very bittersweet message. And I'm not sure that I want to, maybe the person is quite young or something, I might say, and the grandmother is quite young, I might say, why don't you wait 10 years and see if they come looking? I don't feel comfortable with that. So there are quite a lot of instances where I think, I mean, somebody else might be prepared to do the work, but I'm just not comfortable with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think that gives you a very unique perspective, which is it feels like learning about you and how you do things, that you have this kind of holistic approach in terms of the emotional support that you know is needed along a journey like this, and the kind of safeguarding of the psychological experience of this as well. Like, how much of your social work do you think feeds into this process of tracing and making those big decisions?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, I don't work alone. So at all times I'm working with an ASA, Adoption Support Agency, and sometimes with two or more. Mm. So, you know, and of course, as all social workers, I get supervision. I have dilemmas. I'm thrown into situations where I'm not quite certain what is the right thing, and need to talk through that with somebody wiser than I am. So, but of course, I wouldn't be doing the work I do in the way I do it if I wasn't a social worker. And my registration is kept up to date. You know, I think of myself as a social worker first, and think that what the task that I do as a social worker is, I trace missing family members. I don't think of them as separate.
Ariel, I know every situation is completely unique, but is there patterns in terms of the people who contact you and their needs and who they are as people as well? You know, you said that sometimes people are looking for people who've just turned 18. For some reason in my head, I always assumed that it would always be people who are older in their lives, having had more time to think and reminisce and look back at who they are, that would be approaching you for finding missing family members. But is there a pattern in terms of who the people are that contact you?
I think that the sort of traditional wisdom is that when people have children of their own, that there's the sudden trigger that they have this child who often is the first person to whom they are genetically connected that they've ever seen.
Right.
So it's a very powerful thing, number one. And secondly, that child may look like or have attributes that they don't quite get or quite see. And then is a huge trigger to search. The other time that is very classic is when people often don't search because they feel it would be disloyal to their adopters.
Sure.
And when their adopters die, people feel free to do so. And that's a sort of curious business, of course, because usually, not always, the birth parents are younger than the adopters. Often one can find the living birth parent, but that's another trigger time, you know,
right.
An amazing trigger time. Most recently, the growth of leisure DNA, so things like people interested in their family trees, putting themselves on Ancestry, 23andMe and so on, has opened up this amazing, amazing thing. All through my career, I would have foundlings come to me and say, could I help them find their families of origin? And I wouldn't take them on. I mean, I just thought it would be wrong to offer hope where I knew there was none. And suddenly, in the last 3-4 years, we're able to resolve the mysteries of the birth of foundlings. So a child that was left somewhere by usually a very distressed parent, we can now find those parents and perhaps navigate some sort of conclusion. Certainly we can offer to the foundling information, knowledge about where they come from, who their families of origin were. And sometimes we can affect contact. And I think that is, for me, it is amazing. It's just an extraordinary thing, in some ways magical.
Absolutely. It's so mad, your job, like in terms of you're just opening doors for people, aren't you? You're just unlocking doors and allowing people these huge revelatory experiences and also these whole upheavals of self-worth, of having thought they weren't wanted to then being wanted or understanding that they were wanted, understanding context. And how are you not an emotional wreck? I don't know.
Well, I think that's the business about seeing oneself as a functionary in some ways. I think that's quite a useful word. I know the emotions that people have are not mine. You know, I think that's they're separate.
Can I ask you about the mother and baby homes in Ireland? Because that's been so big in the news and something I see and follow closely is this whole revelation over there of the realities of what happened in those homes. Have you ever had to deal with any of stories regarding those people?
Yes, I mean, I've worked on quite a lot of those stories, albeit now some time ago, because I think there's a more unified both help and groups that are together. But I remember a particular piece of work I did, and it always has stuck with me. A birth mother came to me saying, I had a child and I lived in the nursery with the child. And it was at one of these homes. And because the child had something, I think it might have been a cleft or something, needed a small repair done. He wasn't adopted as when he was very young. And she worked in the laundry and would go every night and creep in and be allowed by the nursery nurse to see her baby, who knew her as mum. And one day when the child was three, she was taken in the car with the child, and the child was removed from her forever, and she never saw him again. And I was asked to find him. The story was he'd gone to America. That was the story. That's what she said to me. So I realised he must have had to have a passport to go.
Right.
So I contacted the passport office in Dublin. This would have been now, 1990. And I said to them, look, you issued a passport in this name. Can you tell me, please, when it ran out and where it ran out? What happened to it? And I got back a stock letter saying, no, we can't help you. And then I got a phone call from somebody, I assume from the passport office, from a man. And he said, you know that inquiry you made? I said, yes. He said, well, the passport was sent back from this part of America and we got notification and this is the name you're looking for. And the phone went down. And I never knew who it was. And if he's there, thank you very much. And I was able to find not the young man, but his adopting parents.
Right.
When I got to his adopting parents, this was their story. They said they had been told that this boy was an orphan. He had no one. They had no idea that his mum was with him for 3 years. They said when they took him on the flight, he stretched out in such terror at being with these strangers in an aeroplane going to, and he never really recovered. And he had had a lifetime of psychological problems, in fact. And when we found him, they loved him. They were just about in touch with him. But he lived a life of a survival life in another town, it's completely separate, he'd not been able to make a family or have a job or anything.
Yeah.
And it was quite extraordinary. And his parents paid for him to come back to London to meet his mother and his sister and his family. And it was very moving, actually. It was moving. Just the thought of this child and the dislocation he had suffered and that his adopters had adopted him in good faith.
Yeah, I think that happened a lot.
And that amazing man somewhere in
amazing,
Ireland.
Isn't it? That one phone call
changed
so many people's lives.
And of course, so many people had the information on the birth certificates altered and changed and incorrect and so on. DNA will be making a difference. It's in its infancy to some degree yet, but it will make a difference. And actually, quite interesting, partly because so many Irish records were lost in the 20s, and partly because there's such a powerful Irish diaspora, in the States, in Canada, in Australia, and they're all interested in their backgrounds. In fact, the uptake on things like Ancestry DNA and 23andMe amongst the Irish community is very high. And it's great. I've always gone to Ireland. I mean, right since I started work, I have mad adventures being driven by wonderful, crazy drivers, round tiny roads in Kerry to go and find a village where a birth mother came from. I love Ireland, but certainly the DNA way of doing things will be helping.
Ariel, I wanted to ask you about the falling rates of adoption now and how there seems to be a very downward trajectory in terms of how many people are adopting. And I can imagine there's various reasons for that, but What is your opinion on that, and how do you think it could change moving forwards?
Well, I mean, the obvious reasons for it are, firstly, there's no social stigma now if a woman gets pregnant and wants to keep her child.
Yeah.
There's not a chaper. Nowadays, perhaps people use surrogates or IVF and so on to try very hard to have their own babies. If you're not going to have the availability of babies, the children that are available to you are perhaps children who have had a very difficult time within their families. What often they need is incredible amount of support after the adoption itself. I think there's a realisation about this now, more and more, that when children are placed for adoption who have come from a difficult background, it's only the beginning of the story. What we now need to be putting in place, and I'm sure we do, you know, is probably therapeutic relationships, support for the parents, support for the wider family, support for the child. Very complicated. I think modern adoptions are very complicated.
As someone who's experienced many different iterations of family life, what is your definition of family now?
I don't think I have a very clear definition of it, because clearly in my own life, some of my family is not of my genes, whereas, and my children very much are, and I have grandchildren and so on. You know, I'm incredibly lucky. I'm sort of surrounded by varying degrees of separation, if you like. And then I have friends who have been lifelong friends. I mean, I have a friend who lives around the corner from me, who's been my friend since I was 5. I mean, I've got lifelong friendships. They are also, you know, my family. I'm not sure what family is. I think family is those who you love, probably.
Yeah. Ariel, you know the children's home that you were crossed
yes.
with? Yes. Did you ever be able to go back and do anything about it?
It closed. Not as a result of anything I did, I hasten to add. I didn't go back later and fire it. When I worked there, one of the things that struck me about it was that it was this enclosed world where, in a sense, the community did not come in. And I went to the local authority involved and said, look, can we have money for paint, and can we have some decent furniture, and could we make a snug for the, can we do this and that and the other? And they said, no, there's no money. So I then thought, right, what we need is to have a friends of this particular home. And so suddenly members of the community came in, and the place got painted and the place got more comfortable. There would be many things there that were still incredibly wrong. I mean, for example, there was a family there, and the only reason that they were in care, and it used to be the case, was that their parents were homeless. The law was that children had to be kept in a safe place. So in those days, you would take the children into care and just let the parents fend for themselves. You know, there were many things that were structural that over which I did not and could not do very much. But certainly it got painted and they got record players and they got nice furniture and so on. And that was as a result of asking the community to get involved. It was sort of difficult for the local authority to complain about it. I knew what I was doing.
I love it. Ariel, last question. What would you like to change about yourself or the world around you moving forwards, looking ahead?
I mean, it's such a sort of vast question.
I know, I'm sorry.
To answer it. I mean, I think I rather stupidly, when you asked me before, said, oh yes, well, world peace and a gin and tonic. And there is a sort of truth, a terrible truth in it.
I love
you
it.
Know, well, one is the banal.
It's the micro and the macro.
One is the banal and the kind of the here and now, and the other is something so vast that it's impossible. What would I like to see that I can sort of grasp and see as a possibility? Well, I think in this country that the value that we put on children, and by that I mean the quality, you know, the kind of input into education, the money that mothers get, the support that families get, the support to bring up children that families get, is less than it could be and it should be in such a wealthy country as this. So I think that part of the sort of structures that I would like to see different would be that.
Yeah.
We have allowed poverty in this country. We have allowed thousands of children to be brought up in poverty. I don't understand why. Mm. And I think that's about, you know, what as a country our commitments are and what we value.
Ariel, thank you so much. Absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Ah, Ariel. I absolutely loved talking to her. I was transfixed by her. I find her voice quite mesmerizing, quite hypnotic, just in how she spoke. She was so eloquent. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed listening to her. And you can still watch Long Lost Family on ITV. I watched it and cried half a pint of tears in the two episodes I watched. It is unbelievable in terms of how it pulls on your heartstrings. So yeah, let us know what you thought of Ariel and her work. I love to hear it. I love to hear your comments. Last week was the brilliant author Candice Carty-Williams. Shout out to Alex Christofi on Twitter, who said, reeling from the revelation that Candice can read a book in 2 hours. Teach me your ways, I beg you. And Selena, who said, this was another wondrous episode. What Candice says about grief is so true. It does come and sit by you and it can be beautifully reassuring. It walks with you and keeps you together forever. I loved it. Thank you so much. Candice was so generous and it meant for a really emotional conversation. So go back and listen to that if you haven't yet. And of course, go and rate and review and subscribe. It's so nice to have you with us and listening to every episode week in, week out. I'm back next Monday with the one and only Billie Piper, child pop star, award-winning actress, TV creator, writer, director. She is an incredible woman and it's a very honest and fun conversation. I can't wait for you to hear it. This episode was produced by Louise Mason with research from Layla Simone Springer through Rethink Audio, and I'll see you next time. Bye.